I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
All right. Welcome to Nature Biotechnology's First Rounders Podcast. My name is Brady Huggett. I'm the host of this show, and our guest today is Anthony Atala. But before we get to that, before we get to Anthony, our podcast series, Hope Lies in Dreams, launches in 1 week, September 8th. And I will put the first chapter in this feed. It'll show up as a bonus, and you can listen to it here. But we have finished the trailer, and I'm going to play that trailer now. This is a podcast about antisense, the history of antisense. It's a podcast about Stan Crook. It's a podcast about the company he founded. It's a podcast about the disease spinal muscular atrophy. Terrible disease. And I think this story has been undertold. So I'm going to play the trailer for you now. Hold on. Stan Crook told me something once that I've never forgotten. This was back in 2015 when I was interviewing him in a Hilton hotel in San Francisco near Union Square. He was in San Francisco to attend a biotech conference as CEO of a company he founded in 1989. Stan grew up destitute in downtown Indianapolis in the 40s and 50s, an ugly place, as he called it. And as we talked, I asked him how he managed to overcome that neighborhood and his hard upbringing and get himself to college and then beyond.
So mostly desperation and anger. And just the whole idea of having no hope, no aspirations. I mean, poverty is not the loss of money. Of course, it's that. It's the loss of dreams. It's the absence of hope. That's poverty.
The absence of a real future. Yeah.
Beyond that, it's not so. At least from my perspective, it's the inability to even dream. You know.
This is the story of Stan Crook's life. It's the story of the biotech company he founded, and it's the story of a powerful drug discovery technology called antisense. Together, they cracked the degenerative disease known as spinal muscular atrophy, which had been stealing the lives of children and traumatizing families since it was first discovered more than a century ago. From Nature Biotechnology, I'm Brady Huggett, and this is Hope Lies in Dreams.
Couldn't believe and couldn't explain and couldn't understand how this drug could have failed.
Just like one of the more amazing, dramatic moments, certainly, of my life.
So I'm like, I have to sit here and watch my daughter slowly waste away.
Yeah.
Like, that's what I'm going to do.
The winner is Biogen and Ionis for Spinraza.
When you get a shared vision like that with a bunch of people and you have to say goodbye to half of them, It's traumatic.
And that's what I always thought about was hope. SMA, is, especially the infant form, is a terrible disease.
But if I'm telling the truth, that's the truth.
Ten chapters. First one starts in a week. They'll come out 1 week after that. You can find it anywhere you find your podcast. Just look for Hope Lies in Dreams and Nature Biotechnology. You'll find it. I hope that you will listen. We worked really hard on it. Now, back to First Rounders. Anthony Atala, director of Wake Forest Institute for Regenerative Medicine and also a co-founder and chief medical officer at Precise Bio. He's just a real pioneer in regen med. But full disclosure, I went to Wake Forest for my undergrad. And we talked about the school in this podcast. He knows that about me. I know that about him. And it was difficult not to talk about this thing that we have in common. But we also talked about Florida, where he grew up, and how much that has changed since he moved there when he was a boy. His family moved from Peru. And we talked about how he was convinced to include research as part of his professional interest. He was just going to be a clinical physician. That's all he wanted to be. And someone said, no, you might be good at research. And obviously that changed the direction of his career. We talked about how he was convinced to leave Boston and take his lab and his career down to Winston-Salem, you know, this sort of small city in North Carolina, and what that has meant to him. And plenty more. He's just a really nice person and was a joy to talk to. So let's get into it. Here's your first Rounders podcast with Anthony Atala. Listen up.
Oh, my pleasure to do this. Now, I heard you have a weight connection.
I do. Yeah, I went there for undergrad.
Did you? That's great.
When I was there, the Institute for Regenerative Medicine wasn't even there. And
exactly.
The school has changed so much that, I want to talk about all that, about what the school is doing and how it's sort of tied in with the economy now of downtown and everything else. It's fascinating. I'm familiar with your work. Of course, you've published in our pages and, your work is translational. I think you've got something like 250 patents, both U.S. and international combined, and we track that. And so I've come across your work before, but I realize I don't really know your path through medicine and science. All I know is that you were born in Peru.
That's funny. Yeah, I was actually. Yeah, it's interesting.
How did that happen? What's your family's background?
Oh, yeah. You know, basically, I was born in Peru and we moved here when I was very young. Then I just did all my schooling here, you know, from grade school on, basically.
Yeah. What was the reason for, you know, one of your parents' jobs or something like that?
Yeah, it was job related. It was job related. And then, our whole family moved. It was really great. You know, I mean, actually, you know, obviously it, changed my life. Really did.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, the move was to Coral Gables.
Yeah, it was to Florida. That's right.
Yeah. Is that kind of, I imagine it's sort of like almost like a bedroom community of Miami. Is that right?
That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah. I grew up in Coral Gables and also a little bit in the Boca Raton area.
Oh, you guys moved.
Yeah, I was in Boca Raton, the Boca Raton area, Miami, Coral Gables area, the Miami area. It was nice. You know, it was a nice time to be there. You know,
yeah,
it was, you know, there was nothing there. You know, I tell you, everything closed down at 9 o'clock, you know,
right.
Nothing, yeah. You know, it's kind of, it's amazing what's happened there.
So do you go back there much now? Like what are the changes?
Oh, it's crazy. I mean, that whole area, both Miami and Boca Raton are basically unrecognizable to me.
That's what I would have thought.
Yeah. It's just the growth in Florida. I was just thinking of that this morning because I was reading somewhere, you know, they talked about Florida having 1,600 miles of beautiful beaches. And I said, I guess that's what did it. That's where Florida went.
Right. Yeah. Well, I feel like that and the theme parks, it just made it a destination for families. Usually at some point of their children's lives, they would bring their kids down to Florida.
Amazing, right? I think when Orlando, Disney World opened up in Orlando, you know, they kept it a big secret, of course, for all those years buying that land.
They did. I didn't know that.
Yeah. And, because they had Walt Disney in California.
Right.
And then they actually ended up buying all this land, which was really, you know, it's interesting because in California it was desert land, right? In Orlando it was swamp land.
Right. They got it sort of cheap and developed it.
And developed it, yeah.
Amazing. And they didn't tell anybody they were doing it.
No, they didn't tell anyone they were buying all that land. But then they announced they were opening up the park there.
And I assume that is what drew, you know, Busch Gardens.
Exactly. All of them are there. Universal Studios.
Universal Studios. Right. Yeah. Yeah. And that's all because Disney opened up their second
home there.
Yeah. Their second home. Yeah.
Much bigger than Walt Disney, you know.
Yep. Yep. Disney. And then, of course, Miami's become, you know, kind of this really internationally known city now.
Yeah. It's crazy. Are we diving into the podcast now?
Yeah.
Great.
Yep.
Now we're starting it?
Starting it.
Okay, yeah. That's good. Okay, let's do it.
Because I'm usually curious about how people got into their careers, and I'm wondering if your parents the move to the United States was for a science career, or what did your family do?
Oh no, you know, it was basically, they were in business, They were into business. And there's no science or medicine in my family at all whatsoever. Huh. At whatsoever. And in fact, when I said, when I was a young child and I said I want to be a doctor, my dad said, you know what? Doctors just work too hard. And I just said, okay, well, then I guess I won't be a doctor. he said, you know, they work hard. Well, you know, this is what he said. He said, they work hard and they're away a lot from their families.
True enough, yeah.
No, he said they work very hard and they're away a lot from their families. And you know, you're just married to your job. And I said, okay, well, I guess I won't do that then. And then I kind of just diverted to doing other things.
Then I was gonna
do business, actually. I said, okay, I'll just do business, you know, like the rest of my family.
Yeah.
And like my dad. And then when I got to college, I said, you know, I really do want to do, this is really what I want to do. I really do want to go back to what I wanted to do as a child, which was
medicine.
Yeah. And then I had no intention whatsoever of doing research. None. Zero.
You were going to see patients. That was your goal.
Patients. That was my goal. I was just going to be a clinician. And my goal was to, you know, see patients in private practice and practice by the beach.
Oh, know? Really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right.
Which so I this, love.
What was the family business? What was the business that your dad was in?
Oh, they were doing all kinds of different things. You know, they were doing, they were involved in like creating manufacturing, in the manufacturing business. And they were, it's interesting because, you know, from my perspective, you know, business was fun. You know, I mean, you talked about it at dinner table and it was what I grew up with, right? I mean, this is, you know, but then I realized, gosh, you know, when you're in business, your main goal is just to go ahead and just make money. That's your goal,
yeah.
Right? That's what you're in business for, create products and make money. And I just said to myself, you know, it's got to be, I just rather do something else, you know, rather do something else with my life.
As you said, you wanted to be a doctor. That's because you wanted to help patients.
Right, exactly. I wanted to help patients, yeah. And it's interesting because, you know, there is something special about being a physician and taking care of patients. There's something very special about that. That's what I wanted to do. You know, that's really what I wanted to do. And I was basically inspired by a family doctor that would come over to the house and see us, you know.
Like house calls.
Yeah, house calls. And he'd sit around the house and he'd talk to everybody and see everybody. He's like, this is really cool. I mean, you know, this person can listen to everybody's problems and just really help everybody out. I really love that concept, you know.
So could you sort of see that he had a level of respect in the community, right? But also you liked the way that he was able to figure out what was going on by the things they said?
It was not so much any level of respect in the community, because this was actually, you know, I had no idea of that, right? I was very young. But I did know that he would make house calls, and I had no idea of, so you know, the social standing, mm-hmm. social standing or anything. But because we were in a, you know, not necessarily a small city, but the fact was that he had this knack for just sitting down and, you know, taking care of me when I was sick and making me better. You know, and taking care of my family members at the same time. Everybody was, oh, yeah, it was like a social event, you know.
When the doctor came.
Yeah, it was a social event. Everybody gather around the living room and talk to him. And everybody would tell him what's going on with their health. And he would basically say, do this, do that.
Oh, he'd do the whole family at once, sort of like a checkup. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, he would do one at, you know, but he would.
I mean, one at a time, but he would.
Yeah.
Interact with every member of the family while he was there. Yeah.
He would interact with every member of the family while he was there. And so it was fun. You know, I enjoyed seeing that. And I enjoyed saying, wow, that's really cool. I really would love to do that. You know, but I had no intention whatsoever of doing research, none.
So when you went to college, you went to the University of Miami, sort of right next door.
I did.
And when you went into college, were you already decided back on medicine or you were thinking about something else?
No, that's when I decided I'm going to go back to doing medicine.
And you majored in psychology.
Well, I had, that's interesting. I actually had I love sciences, so I ended up taking both a lot of biology courses and a lot of chemistry courses. I needed to graduate finally. You know, I had all these credit hours and I needed to graduate.
Yeah.
And it turned out that I could, I just needed like, I was one class away from making any of this my majors, you know. My, and somebody said, well, you know, you have enough courses in psychology to,
Okay.
Just go ahead. And I said, okay, I'll pick psychology. So I had a lot of courses in chemistry and biology and apparently psychology too, because I guess I liked it. Not by choice, just the courses I took.
So that was almost like a default major because you had the most credits in it.
Yeah, it was a default major.
Wow.
And that's what I did.
So you're in college and you're majoring in all these sciences and leaning toward medical school, I would assume at that point. And you did, yes. When you told your dad, did he say, why are you making this awful decision to burden yourself with a hardworking career?
No, at that point, he was fine. He was fine with it, you know? And you know how you're very impressionable when you're young.
Right.
You know? And so a statement from your dad, you don't, you know, just take it, you know, to heart.
Right.
Whereas when you're older, you can discuss it and say, well, this is what I want to do. He was happy about it at the point.
Yeah. Yeah. So then I think for medical school, you went to the University of Louisville, right?
That's right.
Right. So at this point, you're thinking, I'm definitely going to be a doctor. Did you have a specialization in mind?
Well, you know, tell you what, I knew that I definitely did not want to do any surgical specialty. I wanted to do a non-medical specialty. And like anything else, it's like everything else in my life, nothing that I ever planned turned out to be the way I thought it would. Because I walked into the operating room, I actually picked surgery as my very last rotation of my actual clinical rotation. So it was my very last rotation because I was convinced I was not going to do surgery. And then I walked into the operating room and it was love at first sight. I
said, really?
Yeah. I said, oh my gosh, this is just amazing. Truly amazing.
So first off, why were you not into surgery? You just didn't want, you wanted maybe that one-on-one interaction? I don't know.
You know, because it was going back to my family doctor. You know, I wanted to take care of these patients and figure out what was going on and use your stethoscope and, you know, listen to someone's heart and you can tell what murmur they have just by using the stethoscope and that kind of stuff. And, you know, I thought, you know, surgery was more like cut them up and fix them kind of thing, you know.
Right.
Not much thought process behind it, so I thought.
I was just talking about this. My last guest, the idea of someone else diagnoses the problem and the surgeon fixes it. You were at first being like, I'm going to be the one that diagnoses the problem. But once you got in that surgery room, you're like, I'm going to be the one that fixes it.
And, you know, interestingly, that's why I chose the field I did, you know, because, you know, I'm a urologist by training. But actually, that specialty is just perfect for me because in that specialty, you really do the diagnosis and you also do the surgery. And it's true. Many surgical specialties is just someone else makes a diagnosis. In urology, you're pretty much the one making the diagnosis almost all the time. And so it was just, and I just fell in love with surgery. You know, it's a great field. You go in there and, you know, and there's something nice about being able to go in somewhere and just fix the problem right there and then, you know.
Can you remember when you went in the room, what it was that, you know, sort of triggered something in your brain and you thought, this is what I want?
It was absolutely great, right? Getting up to that table and seeing the surgeon, here I'm a medical student, and walking up to that operating room table and seeing that surgeon just, you know, have an amazing fund of knowledge and being able to anatomically go right to where you need to go. I mean, you make the decision, right? And then you go exactly where you need to go. And you know all the anatomy and you know where all the things are and you know what you need to do to actually fix the problem. I was just, you know, mind boggling to me. Again, it was just fascinating and very, very inspiring that by the time we left that room, that patient was totally closed back up, you know, stitches in place, everything was fine and the problem had been solved.
Huh. That's interesting. So you like that idea of like, okay, when this person came into this room, there's a problem. They've left it now and we fixed it.
Exactly. And there's something nice about that, you know, and so, and in my practice now, of course, I see both kind of patients. I see the patients where I do surgery and it's fixed and it's done. But then I also see those patients that I follow for years and years, you know, patients that I treated them when they were newborns.
Really?
And I'm still seeing them, you know, I'm still seeing them 20 years later.
Wow.
You know, because they do have these conditions that you have to keep managing.
So you did your residency in Louisville too, right?
Yes, I did.
And from there, I think you got a fellowship to Boston Children's Hospital.
That's right.
Can you take me along that path?
That was great. Louisville was great. I just loved the University of Louisville and the School of Medicine there. You know, and then got to Boston. And of course, that was for my, you know, final stages of my training. And that's where my boss actually called me up, and they were adding a research track to the clinical training. They were adding a research track. And he called me up, and this is Dr. Alan Reddick. He was the head of the program, and he was a surgeon in chief of Children's Hospital and Harvard Medical School. And he called me up and he said, you know, we are adding a research track this year, so we're going to give you first choice to do just the clinical track or the clinical track plus the research track. And I immediately said, you know, Dr. Reddick, I thank you for your offer, but I'm definitely just going the clinical track.
Yeah.
That's all I want to do. And he said, really? And I said, yeah, really. And I said, interesting. Because I think you would do well with adding the research track. I think it'd be good for your career. It'd be good for you. And why don't you think about it? And why don't we connect in about a week or so? Because we need to make a decision of who's going to do what. Because they added that research track, they were adding one extra candidate to their match. So I did. I did think about it. Talked to my friends, my mentors, my professors, my wife, and a week. And I really did think about it very seriously. So he called me back and he said, okay, have you made up your mind? Are you going to do just the clinical track or the clinical track plus the research? And I said, well, Dr. Reddick, I really appreciate it, but I'm still only going to do the clinical track. I've really thought about it. I'm only going to do the clinical track. And he said, really?
When you're thinking about it and you're talking to your mentors and your friends, what are they telling you? That, research is probably not for you, or you know you want to be in a clinical side, so maybe just stay in that path?
Yeah, because, you know, that's typically, you know, interestingly, that's typically the medical path, right? You're going... pretty much everyone's there because they want to go and practice medicine.
Right.
And so everybody said, well, you know, unless you're really going to do that as a career choice, I mean, why would you want to do that? And I said, okay, you're right. I guess I shouldn't do it. And, you know, so when he did call and I said, I really did think about it. I mean, I really did. And I said, well, I'm still not going to do it. You know, at which point he said, well, okay, is your wife home? It's a true story. He tells the story all the time. And I said, yeah, she's home. And so, can I say hello? I said, sure. So he got on the phone with my wife, talked to her, and got off the phone, gets off the phone, looks at me and says, okay, you really got to do that research track.
He asked for your wife. She talked to him and hung up, and he never talked to him again. She ended the conversation.
Well, yeah, she actually said, no, she actually did hand me the phone back and says, well, you know, it's nice.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Why don't you guys talk about it some more and we'll connect? So, you know, we get off the phone and she says, well, you really ought to do that research track. You really ought to do that research track.
Why? What was he saying? What did he tell her?
Well, that was my question. I said, why? That was exactly my why. And she's like, because, you know, he knows what's best for you. You know, obviously he's been around. He's, you know, he directs the program. He probably knows what's best for you in your career. And that's what he was saying. He thought that would be that would be best. But
I mean, in retrospect, he was correct, right? I mean, absolutely, he was correct. But how did he know that?
Well, you know, I had actually written papers during my, you know, residency. And so I did publish. I had published papers, but they were clinically related papers.
Right, right.
Not basic research papers. But I did make an effort to I did love the academic track at that point. And I had already started in that mindset, you know. My initial mindset, as you know, was I'm going to do private practice by the beach somewhere. But
by
the time that residency started moving forward, I really, really loved the thought process of trying to, you know, solve problems. You know, how do you actually get you know, why are patients doing this? You know, can we accumulate this data and try to figure out why this is actually happening? And so I had already published a number of papers. So he actually said, you know, I think you'll be better for an academic, you know, this would be better for you for an academic career for you to have this experience. Hmm. And that really totally changed my life. It really did. You know, it really totally changed my life.
The questions that you would be looking at as an academic researcher are new problems, right? Yeah. New undiscovered things yet. How do we, let's get this data and figure out if there's a new problem that we can tackle. That must have been kind of exhilarating to think about.
You know, it's amazing. Research is, I tell you, it's unbelievable, right? To actually just ask the question, is amazing, right? And then you say, well, has anybody else asked this question? And then, well, has anyone solved this? And so it was just really something that really just spoke to me. You know, research just really grabbed me. Once I couldn't believe it, really. I couldn't believe that I actually loved it so much. And it was just one more area that I really never thought I would like that I ended up liking. I mean, you know, it's just, so my belief is that in life is, you know, try all these different things because you will never know what will, you know, what you will actually, so if a door opens up, just go through it.
Right. You don't have to stay in there, but at least go in there and look at it.
Go in there and look at it, you know, because you'll never know what your passion will be unless you really are exposed to it. And that really changed the way I, you know, I train folks. You know, I really want to make sure they get exposed to a lot of different things.
So your wife basically convinced you. After that phone call, she's like, he's telling me, and I agree with him now, that you should do this. And you said, okay, I'm going to do it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, I said, okay, it's fine.
Well, how long were you there?
So at Boston Children's, I was there for 14 years.
Oh, 14. Okay.
Yeah, because after finishing my training, I stayed there as a faculty member. I actually, you know, started my lab at that point and just stayed there as a faculty member before coming to North Carolina.
So this former dream of yours, which is having a small clinical practice someplace by the beach, those are both out the window. You're in Boston, which, I mean, they do have beaches, but it's not quite what you had in mind. And you're doing most of your effort is in research at that point? So you are seeing patients?
Yeah, I was still seeing, I still see patients today. So it's still a part of what I do. I never gave, you know, one of the interesting things is people, it's very hard to do both. You know, it's very hard to do both research and clinical. But I always felt that it was so important for me to remain and keep doing the clinical because that's really, I love doing the clinical work. I really do. And you need the clinical work to really inspire you for the next question. And that's what keeps you, and I can go to my colleagues in the operating room and I can ask them what's going on and I can find out what's going on in other areas and I can see where the clinical problems are. You know, to be a translational researcher, you have to stay up to date with a clinical problem. So I enjoy doing it. I love taking care of my patients. I love being in the operating room, but I also love the fact that helps my research.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now, imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Right. It's not only your own seeing patients, but you ask around. What are you seeing with your patients? So you always are sort of keeping up to date on what's happening.
Absolutely. So important. Because, you know, in Regen Med, you're covering all these different tissues and organs, right?
Right.
I mean, something you do in one area applies to other areas. And if you don't know what's coming down the pike, you may be working on yesterday's technology.
Right.
It's so important to know that. So important where the fields are moving, to know where.
So tell me, in this 14 years, where your research moved to? I'm assuming when you got there, of course, you didn't even really know what you're going to do for research, but then you must have picked up areas that you thought, I'm really good at this, or this interests me. And over that 14-year period, somehow you become, you know, kind of a leader in regenerative medicine.
So, you know, what happened was that when I got to Boston, it was an empty lab, actually. It was an empty lab, and the scientist, because it was a new, remember, they were starting their research.
Yeah, you were ground zero.
And the lab was a new lab. It was pretty much an empty lab. And the scientist they had hired to run the lab had not yet arrived. He was not arriving for another, 6 weeks or so. Hmm. And he did send a technician down there to start buying stuff and setting up the lab, Paul Guthrie. And the scientist was Michael Freeman. And Michael arrived 6 weeks later. And so I certainly did not want to sit around for 6 weeks. So that's when I decided I would, work on this project that had to do with, growing tissue and, by talking to different people, and knowing what was going on around me. And so by the time that the scientist arrived, Michael Freeman, he said, well, can you, do you want to work on my project? And I said, well, actually, I already started this other project. Can you help me out with this project? And he just laughed and he said, yeah, what are you working on? And he did. He mentored me through this.
He was 6 weeks too late. I mean, the project was underway at that point.
Yeah. It's only a 1 year research experience. So I did not want to waste 6 weeks out of that.
Right. Yeah.
That 1 year. Of course, I kept doing the research through afterwards. But it's one of those things where I didn't want to waste 6 weeks. And so by the time he got there, he said, sure, I'll help you out. And the project was really to try to grow bladder tissue at that point. That was the project.
Yeah.
And that I decided to work on. And it's interesting because it just really made it made such a difference, right, for me to have this project and to say, can you help me do this? And for me to be able to go in this totally impossible project of growing bladder tissue. Because if I had known then what I know now, I was so naive, right? I mean, I had not been in a research lab. I would have never said that. I would have never said, well, I want to grow bladder tissue.
You mean how difficult it would be?
Yeah, how difficult
yeah.
it would be.
Yeah.
Very, very difficult. And so I was very naive, thinking this is going to be a one-year project. It was one of those things that I'm glad I asked that question. I never regretted asking the question and trying to get it answered.
Yeah, that sort of set your whole career in a new direction.
It did. It really did. Because then basically 8 years later, almost 9 years later, we ended up implanting the first organ, the first bladder tissue inside a patient. So that really, it was one of those things that by asking that first question and just going through all those challenges, I mean, we couldn't even get the cells to grow at that point.
So let's talk about that. You're using the patient's own cells.
Yes.
You were, right?
Right.
So that's first step is, okay, get these cells and grow them. That's the first hurdle.
Yes.
And you had to get the scaffolding right, which I assume is a big hurdle as well.
Big hurdle.
And then when that's done, can we surgically implant this, the scaffold disintegrate, and then have this bladder function in the human? I mean, these are all massive challenges. No wonder it took so long.
They were massive challenges. They were massive challenges. And just to get cells to grow, as 30 years ago, most human cell types could not be grown or expanded outside the body.
Yeah.
And so for me, the expansion stage was critical because I realized that if we could not expand the cell, normal human primary cells outside the body, we could never get to that goal. It would just be a research experiment. So yeah, we could reconstitute cells by just taking them out and putting them in a scaffold and seeing what would happen. But people didn't even believe that, right? People did not believe that tissue could reconstitute itself. So in fact, my very first abstract was totally rejected. You know, and I would say when we finally were able to show that cells would grow and reconstitute themselves in a scaffold and start forming tissue, the abstract was fully rejected. And
by everyone.
Yeah, by the major meeting that we went to, and I couldn't believe it. And I saw the program chair at another meeting, and I was totally shocked. I said, I couldn't believe it. I couldn't, you know, we worked so hard to get this to work. And so I went up to him and I says, you know, I don't know if you remember this, but I submitted this abstract and it didn't get accepted. And he said, which abstract? I said, well, this abstract that we're able to get these cells and put them on a scaffold and the cells reconstituted. And I said, oh, yeah, I remember that abstract. He says, well, I just want to know, why did the abstract get rejected? Oh, because that's not possible. It can't be done. And I said, what do you mean it can't be done? We just did it.
Yeah.
He says, no, it can't be done.
That's fascinating, because I've heard this from other people. When you're doing something that's absolutely on the cutting edge like that, the first thing is you have to get people to believe you.
Oh, it's crazy.
That you've just done it.
It was crazy. You have no idea. It's amazing, right? So many people that say, you know, well, it's not true. I mean, you know, they just don't believe it. It can't be done. It can't be done. So you're just standing there saying, what do you mean it can't be done? You know, we just show that it can be. Maybe I want to bring it to the lab and show you every step on how it
gets
done.
Yeah. Well, did you eventually, did he reconsider eventually, or you must have?
No, of course that meeting, you know, he already planned the meeting, et cetera. But then
I meant like the next year something.
Next year.
Okay.
But you know, it's just a funny experience, right? It's just a really interesting experience. If you do something in the research arena and somebody just says, it's like, what? We're not making this up. You know, it's not like we're just putting together a piece of paper and making this stuff up.
Can I ask, I assume that you focused on the bladder first as far as regenerating tissue, because as a sort of organ, the bladder is somewhat simple, right? It's got to contain urine and release urine, but it isn't like the lung, for instance, or I don't know, the pancreas or something like that. Am I correct?
It's interesting, right? So it is more complex than other. It's not a great first tissue to start with, because in reality, flat structures like skin are the least complex,
right?
Architecturally, tubular structures like blood vessels, or you know, those are the second level complexity, architecturally more complex. But hollow non-tubular organs like the bladder are really the third level of complexity, with solid organs being the most complex. And interestingly, again, if we had known that, we would have never started with a level 3 organ. But the interesting thing is that by starting with a level 3 organ, it really made it simpler for us to tackle flat and tubular structures. It definitely was simple. But, you know, but you're absolutely correct in saying that it's not as complex as a solid organ, because that is like the lung. You said it right. I mean, there's nothing, I mean, the complexity between flat, tubular, and hollow organs, you know, it's a gradual increase in complexity. The complexity
in the lung
level 3 to a solid organ is just monumental. Yeah. Difference. So you're right. Wow. Yeah.
So that was a big breakthrough for you, and probably for your career as well.
You know, you're working on this stuff. I'm just doing research work. That's really all it is, right?
Yeah.
But that paper, when that paper came out, it just got a lot of, it had a lot of attention. I'd never expected that, really.
Oh, you didn't?
No, not at all. Zero.
Oh.
Zero.
I mean, you didn't. You know, it's sort of this first implanted bladder that you knew. You must have known that would have been a big deal.
Well, but this was in the preclinical model when I submitted to Nature Biotech.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
And so at that point, I was just, you know, it's a preclinical model. It was a large animal model, you know, so, it, you know, we were able to show that it worked. And but I had no idea, right? I mean, the paper got into the journal, into Nature Biotechnology, made the cover, mm-hmm. and it really did get attention. And I just was totally surprised by it, totally shocked. I said, gosh, I had no idea, you know, because, you know, you're just doing your work again. You know, remember, I was on a clinician track. I really didn't have any expectations out of the research track. I was just trying to answer this question.
So when that paper came out and it was on the cover, did that change? I don't know, like maybe not your perception, but other people's perception of you?
You know, for me, it was just, okay, we have to keep going. You know, we're working on all these other tissues. It was not, you know, the interesting thing is because of, I mean, just think, you know, when I think about it, all these other tissues we wanted to tackle, right? So there was so much to do. In my mind, it's okay, we got, you know, this one down a little.
Let's keep going.
Right? Let's keep going. There's so many other ones we can go after using the same strategy. It's like, you know, it was overwhelming in reality. And I really didn't, I didn't stop to think about perceptions or anything. I just, you know, one thing, you know, I'm fairly, I guess isolated in that manner because I just do my work and I really don't think about what, you know, I just put my head down and do my own work. That's been much what I've done my whole career.
How did you get to Wake Forest?
You know, so I had been in Boston for a number of years.
14 years or something.
Yeah, 14 years. Yes. And interestingly, we had published another paper, Nature Biotechnology, that was the one about the kidney paper, a kidney that where we actually were able to, it was during the cloning time, you know, it was during the cloning era. And it's interesting, right? Because we started working on, remember the term RegenMed had not even been created when we published the bladder paper. And certainly stem cells had not yet been discovered when we started this work. And cloning, you know, when cloning came about, you know, we started this work, cloning had not yet been out there for, you know, when Dolly was cloned. But when Dolly was cloned, I remember calling Ian Wilmot, you know, who cloned Dolly, right? He was one of the major, one of the authors that cloned Dolly.
Yep.
And I knew he was going to be in Boston for a conference. And so I called him up and I said, you know, I'd like to connect with you. You're going to be here. I'd like to see you because I'd like to talk to you about organ regeneration and cloning. You know, so he can't see, he was at a meeting in Boston. We got together, we had dinner together. And Ian, of course, told me all about cloning and how he had done it, et cetera. And one of the main things was, could we actually, we were working on kidney at the time. And we decided that we would try to create a kidney tissue through cloning. That's what we decided to do. And Bob Lanza was a big collaborator of ours in Boston. And so this paper got published, and also in Nature Biotechnology. And this, so one of the people here at Wake Forest called me up. And they said, you know, I just saw that paper. You know, we'd love to see if you can visit Wake Forest. And, you know, we'd love to see if you can, if you're willing to come here for a job. And I said, well, I'm actually not interested. I have no interest in leaving Boston.
Yeah.
So he basically said, well, we'll have you come for a visit. And I said, well, I'll come down for a visit as long as you know that it's just really a visit, you know, just.
Don't give me the hard sell. I'm just coming down to.
Yeah, I'm just coming down for a lecture, and that's it. You know, I'll be happy to come down for a lecture and spend a day with you. But I have no interest in leaving Boston, none whatsoever. So he invited me. I gave my talk. I was here, and you know, next thing I know, I'm meeting with you know, I'm having, you know, cocktails at the president's house, and I'm
It's the hard sell.
And I'm having, you know, a meeting with the presidency of the medical center. And, you know, and so they're, you know, and they basically started approaching me, you know. And I said, really, I really don't have any interest in leaving Boston. But the CEO at the time of the medical center was Richard Dean, Dick Dean. And he was creating a research park down here in Winston-Salem. And he had acquired all this land. And he basically had not been made public yet, but he was acquiring all this land. R.J. Reynolds had donated land to the medical center, and they were acquiring additional land to start a research park here in Winston-Salem.
This is exactly what I want to talk about, because I think this is fascinating, and I think it ties into all these trends that are going on with bioentrepreneurship, actually, across the country and even kind of internationally. But so Wake Forest is this college that had been originally formed in Wake Forest, North Carolina, right? More towards the eastern part of the state. And R.J. Reynolds was this tobacco, is this tobacco, giant tobacco company in Winston-Salem. And they wanted a university in their town. So they brought Wake Forest, they convinced Wake Forest College to be, to come to Winston-Salem and become Wake Forest University, which they did. And the town itself, I mean, Winston's a small town, really. It's about 250,000 people. And tobacco isn't quite what it was. And there has been this sort of tying in between the university, which is sort of on the northwest, you know, northwest of downtown itself, and the downtown area of Winston, with the medical school, with the, I think that's probably why they started the Regenerative Institute, right? Regenerative yes. Medicine Institute, to yes. sort of help grow almost a new economic base for the town, tied into the school, tied into medicine, and they needed talent for it. And that must be where you came in.
Yes, you know, it's interesting. The CEO, you know, said, well, we are building this research park, you know, and
in these old tobacco buildings that have been donated by R.J. Reynolds. Yeah,
exactly. And he said, you know, we want you to be an anchor tenant for the research park. And I said, well, you know, I really don't have really I'm in Boston. I'm here to stay. I'm not going anywhere. So the interesting thing is that the firm they hired to plan the park was in Boston, the planning mm-hmm. firm that they were planning the research park. And so he called me up one day and said, you know, I just want to call you because the dean of the School of Medicine and I we're both going to fly up to Boston to meet with the architectural firm, and we'd like to come and say hi and just say hello and visit you. And visited your, you know, and I said, sure. And they said, yeah, you know, we'd love to get together for dinner. I said, sure, let's do it. They said, well, can we come and visit your lab as well? And I said, sure. And they said, and, you know, once you know, when it's time for the dinner, you know, we'll invite your wife to come, you know, with us. And I said, okay, sure. So
did you have kids at this point?
At this point, yes, I did have kids at this
point. So they were in school. That was something to think about.
They were very
young.
Very young.
Oh, young. Okay. Okay.
Very young. I think we had our, in fact, I don't think, very young. And so they came to visit and they visited the lab and then we went out to dinner and I'm just, you know, hosting them for a visit. I mean, it's just a social visit. You know, they're telling me about all this stuff. And so I excused myself in the restaurant to go freshen up and they turned to my wife and they said, you know, we're here to recruit your husband. And my wife said, well, I don't know about him, but if he doesn't want to come, I'm coming to North Carolina.
This is two times they've turned to your wife to get you to do things, whoever it is, whether it's come to Boston or come to North Carolina.
Two times. Turns out my wife really loves North Carolina. You know, she used to vacation here when she was a child.
Oh.
And in the beaches of the Carolinas.
Yeah.
North Carolina. She's from Ohio. And she used to come to the Carolinas. And so she loved the Carolinas. And so we started a dialogue. And I said, you know, I'm really not movable, you know. But then really, it's amazing, right? Again, the offer just, it was, the more I looked at it, the more I started to see that this was truly an amazing opportunity to really create an inflection point in terms of what we were doing in RegenMed.
Yeah.
Because, you know, in Boston, we had our, you know, laboratory for tissue engineering and regenerative medicine. But, you know, to create an institute was going to be another jump. And to have an investment of, you know, a financial investment to make that happen. But more important, though, was the fact that the state was very much focused on biotechnology. I started learning more and more about it. And it turns out that, you know, first of all, Wake Forest is a great school.
Yeah.
You know, it's a great school. Top 25, yeah. Consistently ranked by U.S. News and World Report as one of the top 25 or, you know, 26 schools in the country out of, you know, 10,000 schools,
yeah.
Right? It's always, it's a great school. But then you start thinking, well, you know, medical center is very well recognized. You know, we are now, you know, part of the Atrium healthcare system, which is in fact the fourth largest academic healthcare system in the country. And Winston-Salem itself, it's just an amazing city. So everything started adding up. But the most important thing is that North Carolina is very, very focused on biotechnology.
Yep.
And so when you look at biotechnology, of course, everyone always thinks about California, right? I mean, it's number one in the country for biotechnology. And just the sheer size, right? California is such a big state that it really overwhelms the rest of the country when it comes to biotechnology. As you know, Massachusetts is number two,
right,
for biotechnology. But guess what? North Carolina is number three. And so, and North Carolina for the last two decades has been, for the last two decades in a row, going now in three decades, it is consistently the state that has the largest growth in the biotechnology industry, decade after decade after decade. So this is now in the third decade that this is actually happening, you know? Mm-hmm. So North Carolina really is growing in amazing ways in biotechnology. And I remember moving here. After I moved here, I remember that a friend from the Boston Globe, who was a head of tech transfer at Children's Hospital, sent me the article from the Boston Globe, from the front page of the business section, that said, "What can Massachusetts learn from the North Carolina biotechnology industry?"
Wow.
And so it's true. You know, I mean, when you take in all the biotechnology in North Carolina and you take the cost of living here and just the beautiful setting and the weather, the traffic, you know, no traffic, all the pluses of the Carolinas, you know, it continues to be a growing state in terms of population and biotechnology. So it's just a great place to be, really. It's a great, you know, finally I said, okay, well, this is a chance to really go to the next level.
Since my wife is already headed down there, I might as well go down there.
Right. She said, "I'm going." I said, "Okay, wait a second. So I'm gonna figure out."
You sort of realized that it could be this. You were one of many things that were happening at Boston Children's, but if you came down and were this, what they call you, a cornerstone tenant? Oh, anchor tenant.
Anchor tenant for the park.
For the park. Then you would have the space and the facilities and the investment they're putting in to really kind of craft this in your own image.
Well, you know, I tell you, I really thought that, you know, Dick Dean and Doug Etchton, and who actually now runs NC Bio, and Terry Hales, they were a team here, and they really, really wanted to bring this biotechnology NIDAS here to Winston. Because, you know, we're just a stone throws away from Research Triangle Park.
Yeah.
And just same thing with Charlotte, right? I mean, we are right in the center, we're right in the middle between Charlotte, which is a banking capital,
you know,
one of the major banking capitals for the country, and Research Triangle Park, one of them, you know, the best known research park in the world, really.
Yeah.
And we're right here in the center. And I was just, you know, it was just really one of those things that when I started looking at all the elements behind it, I said, you know, this is really a good opportunity after all. This is something I really, really, really need to consider. This, regardless of what my wife says.
Can I ask about, so the thing I want to ask about is founding of Precise Bio. Well, you're a co-founder there. Have you you founded another company?
Yeah, I'm a co-founder of Precise Bio. Yeah, I founded a number of companies actually, but typically, my philosophy has been not to get involved in companies. So I don't get involved in the companies because you know.
So you spin the technology out, but then that's it.
We spin the technology out, and that's it. That's really
right.
What
okay.
That's really what we do. Precise Bio is actually different because the technology was not a spin out of Wake.
Right.
And so I decided that it was a spin out of it was a laser technology for printing, but they needed expertise in Regen Med. And so,
right. So Arya Bhatt, right, is the co-founder.
Arya Bhatt is a co-founder, exactly.
They had the bioprinting. And they needed sort of expertise in cell regeneration or tissue growth.
Exactly. Yeah, they had a printer, actually. They just had a printer. And not even a bioprinter, just a printer. But we had the bioprinting expertise and the RegenMed expertise. So in this case, I did become a little bit more involved because we had to get involved to make – it was not a technology that we were spinning out. It was really a technology that needed that expertise. And so I did get involved.
Tell me how that went. I know that you had a Series A round that I think was mostly funded by Israeli investors.
Yes.
Right?
Absolutely. So the company is actually partially based in Israel and partially based here in Winston. Mm-hmm. And it's been Ari Abad is the CEO. And what I love about it is they're doing things the right way for the right reasons. You know, it's about getting products out to patients. So it's very much aligned to our mission at the Institute here at Wake Forest.
I did some research on the company, but I was wondering about if it was difficult to get the company off the ground because it was not based in Cambridge or the Bay Area, and investors sometimes really like to play in those spots, and they didn't know really what to do with a company that was half founded in Winston-Salem and half founded in Israel.
You know, it's interesting. We've had a good response to the concept, and it's been it was funded well. I mean, we've actually gone, but you know, it's like any startup. I've seen these startups now time and again, and it's really, you know, it takes effort to raise money.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But also, it's very important not to overpromise. You know, it's very, very important not to overpromise. And Ari is great at that. I mean, he just tells you exactly what's going on. I mean, he's just great. You know, he tells it just like it is. And I love that. I love the fact that, you know, you have people raising money who are going to tell you the good, the bad, and the ugly. And they're telling you what the risks are and what's the upside, the potential upside. And they're not just painting a pretty picture all the time. You know, only the true story. And that's what Precise Bio has done. And I think they've been successful at raising funds. But, you know, it's always tough. I would say it's been tougher because of being in Winston, because I think people want to invest in these technologies. In fact, it's the opposite sometimes, right? What I've seen out there, sometimes I just can't believe the amount of money that people are putting into these technologies without really knowing what the reality is. I mean, I get surprised at that all the time.
You mean like these huge rounds you'll see for a startup someplace starting at $75 million or like that?
Yes.
Yeah.
It sometimes seems that the larger the idea and the more impossible it is to get there, the more money you can raise sometimes.
Yeah, that does sound accurate, yeah.
You know, and so, it's so important to make sure that when you do bring people in to invest fund money or, you know, money from funds, et cetera, that people are not going to, you know, you're going to try to do something where you would put your own money. That's so important. And I think doing the raises at the right amount and not being overly ambitious and doing it right. At the end of the day, I think that's a winning formula for doing it right.
I want to ask you one other thing about this. So when was the Institute for Regenerative Medicine actually started? Upon your hire?
Yes. We started the Institute when we moved here. And we moved our group here from Boston, basically.
Yeah.
So we moved about 20 folks down from Boston to start the Institute.
And that was in, I don't know what year that was.
Oh, that was 2004.
2004. Okay. And so my question is, there's a lot of cities or university towns that would like to grow their economy through entrepreneurship and specifically bio-entrepreneurship if they can. And, you know, knowing that the two poles of our country we just talked about, sort of the Bay Area / California and Cambridge, they kind of sprang up organically. And I don't know that if you can actually just go ahead and duplicate that someplace else. But what you can do, I think, is find your area of expertise and then build on that. And it seems like to me that for Wake Forest, they started this institute, they brought down an expert, they started an institute and became a world leader in that technology. And that is how they decided they begin to grow their innovation quarter, begin to grow their startup culture based around their area of strength. And I'm wondering if I'm reading that accurately.
Well, you know, certainly there are so many different areas of strength at Wake, you know, so many good areas of research. I mean, really, some, you know, public health sciences is, you know, very well known at Wake. The cancer research unit, neurobiology. So there's so many areas of strength, really. I think in terms of Regen Med, the difference between Regen Med was that it was an emerging field.
Right.
It was an emerging field, you know, and so we could grow with it, you know, because it was such a, the field was in such a state of its infancy that we could actually really grow that. Because pretty much, think about it, pretty much anything we did was fairly new.
Right. It's almost like putting a first flag down.
Yeah, it really was, because, I mean, I think back to the early days after we had done our initial experiments, said, what other tissue are we going to go after? Because no one else was going after any of these tissues, really.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? So, well, what other tissue were we going to go after? And it was really, okay, well, you know, it was an open field. Really, it was a totally open field, you know? It's a new field, new area. You know, we can try to tackle all these different problems. And so I think it was just, you know, being at Wake and having the support from Wake Forest. But more importantly, also underscoring the importance of the city and the state, you know, in addition to Wake. In other words, everyone being aligned, that biotechnology is a thing, you know, it's a state that really loves biotechnology. Mm-hmm. And so it really made it easy for W Firm to move forward.
So it was not only Wake, but it was the idea that you'd get help from Wake. The state was interested. The city was interested in having something grow in this area where biotech had really not flourished yet.
Yeah, you know, that's right. It's a new technology. Regen Med was fairly new. And, you know, the park, you know, of course, has so many different tenants. And we were just one of the tenants, right?
Right.
We were just one of the tenants. But we were lucky to be here early on, and we were lucky to grow with it.
For Precise Bio, as you said, you're a little more tangled up in this one than you have been in your others. Do you think you'd like to continue to do this?
So, really, the main thing for us over the last decade has really been, how do you make sure that these technologies really succeed in the marketplace? Because that's the only way that patients are going to benefit from it. So if you think about it, we've been working on these technologies now for a number of decades. And mm-hmm. We have a lot of these technologies in patients now, in, you know, clinical trials, phase one, phase two, phase three. And we have about, you know, 15 applications of our technologies are now in patients. So we're implanting our 16th technology this coming year. But for us, it's not just about the research aspect of it or even the clinical aspect. So, you know, we work very, very hard to make sure that these technologies work before we put them into a patient. And work very, very, very hard to make sure these technologies succeed in the patient. But then the missing link, believe it or not, the missing link is manufacturing.
Yeah.
Because we are very good at innovating at the research end, but we're not very good at innovating manufacturing at the same time as the research. And what ends up happening is that all this industry ends up going abroad.
Right.
And so if you think about it, that's what you've seen with the battery business, what you saw, you know, we innovated batteries here. The whole business is abroad. Computers, right? Innovated here, invented here in terms of a lot of innovation, manufactured abroad. So the question is, how can we make sure that we retain this RegenMed industry here in our backyard, in the States? And the way to do that is to really concentrate on manufacturing so that we can innovate in manufacturing so that we can scale up the technologies, make them lower cost, reproducible, more precision, be able to make sure that these technologies are able to be produced in a large scale and large quantities. And that is where manufacturing comes in. And so a lot of what we've done over the last many years is really start this big manufacturing initiative with this test bed that we've created here in Winston-Salem, which is a test bed that where industry donated millions of dollars of equipment so that startups and emerging companies could use this equipment for free. And so they can create their prototypes. And so they can start to innovate the manufacturing process at the time that they're developing their product.
Interesting.
And so by these startups having access to this test bed, and they're able then to save, you know, millions of dollars themselves on equipment that they would have had to purchase to build their prototypes. what the companies that donated the equipment to our test bed to this foundation, a nonprofit foundation, what they get out of it is that they get this dialogue with these startups so they can help to improve their products. And all these products are based on scalability. And so the companies, and guess what? When these startups finally are done with their prototypes and they have to manufacture their product, the companies, they're going to get their equipment from these companies that help them, you know, develop the technology. And what we benefit at in terms of the field in general, we're going to benefit because we're starting a new set of standards and methodologies to help innovate in the area of manufacturing.
So retain the manufacturing. Yeah.
Retain the manufacturing here in the state. So that testbed is here in Winston-Salem as well, along with a workforce development program, which is also nationally based, so that we can train the future folks that are needed in the regen med industry. So we don't get into that problem, right? That we have these companies starting up, and we don't have the expertise, people with the expertise needed to run them. So we have a workforce development program that's actually from, now funded by the Natural Sciences Foundation.
Uh-huh.
We have this incubator as well, so these companies can come in and be in a RegenMed-based incubator where all these companies can help each other out. So when you ask about startups, it's a little bit of a different bent. We are trying to make sure that we can push the field forward at all levels.
Oh, that's fascinating. The career development thing, how are you pulling students or talent from? What's the outreach?
So believe it or not, we start at the high school level.
That's the way to do it, yeah.
Yeah, so we're starting at the high school level with technical schools and high schools and taking it all the way to technical schools and to 4-year and 2-year degree and 4-year degree colleges and universities. So all the way, so the whole gap.
You mean North Carolina schools or schools all over?
Well, so the model was built here for North Carolina. So the grant that we put into the Natural Sciences Foundation was to build the ecosystem here.
Yeah.
But actually, that's being used as a model now to see how we can do that nationwide.
Got it. Okay.
And of course, if we are training folks here in North Carolina, those folks can go anywhere, right?
Yep.
They are part of the national workforce as well.
Okay. Listen, that's all I had. I appreciate you taking the time to do this. Hold on, let me stop this recording. Okay, there it is, your first Rounders podcast with Anthony Atala. I hope that was informative or enjoyable for you, or maybe both. Thanks to the Midwest Quiet for use of your music in this podcast. If you'd like to comment on this show, on Nature Biotechnology, the journal, or anything that we do, you can find us on Twitter. Our handle is @NatureBiotech. The next thing you hear from me will be Chapter 1 of Hope Lies in Dreams. I will put that in this feed. And then after that, another First Rounders. I think I know who the guest is. I think I have that person locked up, but I'm not sure, so I won't say. That's all. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
It's time for another season of The Palmetto Porch, an original podcast from Discover South Carolina. I'm Devin Whitmire. Join me as I get to the heart of what makes South Carolina such a great place to visit by speaking to the locals who make it so special. Premiering December 5th, find The Palmetto Porch wherever you get your podcasts. And for more information about our show, visit scpalmettoporch.com.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit energycitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.